rare effort on Wall Street. But when it came to judging the loyalty of Lehman employees, Gregory could be ruthless, given to angry, impetuous decisions. In the summer of 2006, Fold had hosted a retreat for senior Lehman executives at his vacation home in Sun Valley, Idaho. Alex Kirk, who ran the Global Credit Products Group, and had previously struck Gregory as a disloyal troublemaker, was due to make a presentation, but was unable to make the trip because of an illness. Feeling better, Kirk decided to make the presentation via video feed, and when Gregory saw how well Kirk looked on the video, he was incensed. Kirk was clearly not sick, Gregory was convinced, and his failure to show up in person was nothing less than a personal insult to Fold. "I want him fired," he yelled. Kirk's allies at the firm had to appeal to Bart McDade, Lehman's head of equities, to intervene with Gregory and calm him down. Cooler heads eventually prevailed. The Lehman dealmaker who had prospered most under Fold and Gregory was Mark Walsh, a socially timid workaholic who ran Lehman's real estate operations. An Irish-American native of Yonkers, New York, Walsh made his mark in the early 1990s when he bought commercial mortgages from Resolution Trust Corporation, the outfit established by the federal government to clean up the savings and loan debacle, and packaged them into securities. A lawyer by training, Walsh seemed immune to risk, which impressed Fold and Gregory to no end. They gave Walsh free rein, and he used it to ram through deals much more quickly than the competition. After the developer Abby Rosen closed the $375 million acquisition of the Seagram building in only 4 weeks, Walsh bragged to friends about how swiftly he had been able to execute the deal. Each success bred hunger for more, leading to monstrous deals like Lehman's partnership with SunCal Companies. A land speculator that bought property primarily outside Los Angeles, SunCal secured approvals for residential development and then sold them to home builders at a hefty markup. Lehman pumped $2 billion into what appeared to be its can't-fail transactions. Walsh had virtually unlimited use of Lehman's balance sheet and used it to turn the firm into an all-in, unhedged play on the U.S. real estate market, a giant REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust, with a little investment bank attached, a strategy that worked extraordinarily well right up until the moment that it didn't. At the very height of the market, Walsh concluded his last great deal, a joint transaction with Bank of America, committing $17.1 billion in debt plus $4.6 billion in bridge equity to finance the purchase of Archstone Smith, a collection of premium apartment complexes and other high-end real estate. The properties were excellent, but the price was sky-high, based on projections that rents could be hiked substantially. Almost immediately, the proposition started to look dubious, especially when the credit markets seized up. But given a chance to back out of the deal, Fold declined. The firm had made a commitment, and it was going to stick with it. Gregory made a circuit to rally the troops. "This is going to be temporary," he told Lehman colleagues. "We're going to fight through this." As both Gregory and Fold were fixed-income traders at heart, they weren't entirely up to speed on how dramatically that world had changed since the 1980s. Both had started in commercial paper, probably the sleepiest, least risky part of the firm's business. Fixed income trading was nothing like Fold and Gregory knew in their day. Banks were creating increasingly complex products many levels removed from the underlying asset. This entailed a much greater degree of risk, a reality that neither totally grasped, and showed remarkably little interest in learning more about. While the firm did employ a well-regarded chief risk officer, Madeline Antoncik, who had a Ph.D. in economics and had worked at Goldman Sachs, her input was virtually nil. She was often asked to leave the room when issues concerning risk came up at executive committee meetings, and in late 2007, she was removed from the committee altogether. In the presence of the trading executives, Gregory always tried to make an impression with his market savvy, to such a degree that it became a running joke. Traders eventually came to consider his tips as contrary indicators. If Gregory declared that a rally in oil prices had much further to go, for example, they'd short oil. In recent years, though, a growing contingent of Lehman executives had begun to view Gregory as a menace. He just didn't know enough about what was going on, they thought. The firm was making bigger bets than it would ever be good for, and nobody in the executive office seemed to understand or care. To criticize the firm's direction was to be branded a traitor and tossed out the door. Among those who tried to sound the alarm was Michael Gelband, who had been Lehman's head of fixed income trading for 2 years and had known Gregory for 2 decades. In late 2006, in a discussion with Fold about his bonus, Gelband remarked that the good times were about to hit a rough patch, for which the firm was not well positioned. "We're going to have to change a lot of things," he warned. Fold, looking unhappy, said little in reply. The fixed income guys had been spending a lot of time talking about the train wreck that awaited the U.S. economy. In February 2007, Larry McCarthy, Lehman's top distressed debt trader, had delivered a presentation to his group in which he laid out a dire scenario. "There will be a domino effect," he said, "and the very next domino to fall sideways will be the commercial banks, who will swiftly become scared and start deleveraging, causing consumer borrowing to contract, which will push out the credit spreads. The present situation, where no one thinks there is any risk whatsoever in anything, cannot possibly last." McCarthy went on to conclude that many people today believe that globalization has somehow killed off the natural business cycles of the past. They're wrong. Globalization did not change anything, and the current risks in the Lehman balance sheet put us in a dangerous situation, because they're too high and we're too vulnerable. We don't have the firepower to withstand a serious turnaround. Around that same time, Gregory invited Gelband to lunch just to talk. The two men had never seen eye to eye, and Gelband suspected another agenda. They met in the executive dining room on the 32nd floor, and after chatting for a while, the conversation took a hard shift. "You know," Gregory said firmly, "we've got to do things a little differently around here. You have to be more aggressive." "Aggressive?" Gelband asked. "Toward risk. You're holding back, and we're missing deals." To Gelband's thinking, Lehman had in fact been pushing through a number of deals that didn't make much sense. They were piling up too much leverage, taking on too much risk, and getting into businesses in which they lacked expertise. At times, there appeared to be no strategy whatsoever guiding the firm. Why had Lehman paid nearly $100 million for Grange Securities, an insignificant Australian brokerage? Earlier, there had been discussions about becoming a player in commodities. Had there been a sound reason for acquiring Eagle Energy, a marketer of natural gas and electricity started by Charles Watson, other than the fact that Watson had been a longtime Lehman client, as well as an old pal of Skip McGee? Meanwhile, the firm seemed willing to finance buyouts indiscriminately. Loans to private equity firms were piling up on the books. Some would get securitized and sold, but the pipeline was clogging up. None of that seemed to bother Gregory. The deals that did concern him were the ones that Lehman had failed to get a piece of, like the blockbuster $5.4 billion acquisition of Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper Village, a sprawling complex of more than 11,200 apartments on the east side of Manhattan. Lehman had joined forces with Stephen Ross's related companies, the developer of the Time Warner Center, to bid on the project, but lost out to Tishman Speyer and Larry Fink's BlackRock Realty Advisors. Adding insult to injury was the fact that Lehman considered Tishman, which it had helped buy the MetLife building for $1.7 billion in 2005, one of its closest clients. Because the real estate division technically reported to fixed income, Gregory held Gelband responsible for the missed opportunity on Stuyvesant Town. "We're going to need to make some changes," he said, implying that Gelband should let a couple of heads roll on his staff. The following day, Gelband took the elevator up to see Gregory, who was in a meeting. Gelband barged in and said, "Joe, you said you wanted to make some changes? Well, the change is me." "What are you talking about?" Gregory asked. "Me? I'm done. I'm leaving the firm." "I am very disappointed," was Dick Fuld's characterization of his personal reaction to Lehman's second quarter earnings in a report released at 6:30 a.m. Monday, June 9th. The loss was $2.8 billion, or $5.12 a share. A conference call was scheduled at 10 a.m. to discuss the result, but by then, the blood sport was already well underway on CNBC. "Dick Fuld is Lehman. Lehman is Dick Fuld," said George Ball of Sanders Morris Harris Group. "You've got a management that wears the corporate logo on its heart. It's got to hurt enormously." Fuld and Gregory were watching the coverage in Fuld's office when David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital appeared on the screen. "Are you saying I told you so this morning?" the CNBC interviewer asked him. "Well, it does seem that a lot of things I've raised over the last while seem to have been borne out by today's news," he said, apparently trying to sound as humble as possible under the circumstances. Einhorn discussed his concerns about the extent of SunCal and Archstone's write-downs, and why they hadn't come sooner, and then delivered a strongly worded admonition. "It's time to dispense with the ad hominem attacks and get down to an analysis of what's really going on with this business." That afternoon, Charlie Gasparino, a tenacious reporter on CNBC, began hectoring Kerry Cohen, Lehman's spokesperson, to confirm a tip he had received that Gregory and Callan were about to be fired. Off the record, Cohen dismissed his tip as a useless rumor. But Gasparino, still skeptical, pressed her to go to her boss, Friedheim. "I've got it that Joe and Aaron are leaving the firm," he said. "Unless you go on record, I'm going with it." When Gasparino threatens to go on the air with market-moving information, a reporting tactic for extracting information from sources, most executives, however much they might resent it, tried to comply. Friedheim didn't think any personnel changes were imminent, but before he officially denied it, he marched into Fuld's office. "I'm going to have to use my name," Friedheim told Fuld, making it clear that his own credibility was on the line. "I have to know if you're even thinking about it." "No," Fuld replied. "It's not under consideration." "Well, I'm going to have to talk to Joe," Friedheim said, "because I need to know that he's not thinking about it either. I'm not using my name unless I know it can't happen." "Absolutely not," Gregory stated when Friedheim put the question to him. "You can tell Gasparino you talked to me, and the answer is no." Keeping the lid on Gasparino was a relatively easy task compared to that of containing the pressure building within the firm. Bankers and traders were alternately restless, nervous, and angry. Late that afternoon, Skip McGee forwarded an email to Fuld from Benoit D'Angelin, once his longtime counterpart, the former co-head of investment banking in Lehman's London office. He had left the firm to start a hedge fund. McGee was clearly trying to send Fuld a not-so-subtle hint. "Many, many bankers have been calling me in the last few days. The mood has become truly awful. And for the first time, I am really worried that all the hard work we have put in over the last 6 to 7 years could unravel very quickly. In my view, two things need to happen very quickly. One, some senior managers have to be much less arrogant and internally admit that some major mistakes have been made. Can't continue to say, 'We are great and the market doesn't understand.' Two, some changes at senior management need to happen very soon. People are not and will not understand that nobody pays for that mess and that it is business as usual." Fuld read the note somberly and wrote back to McGee with a promise that he'd have lunch with the top investment bankers to give them a chance to air their grievances. What Fuld did not know was that a palace revolt was already in the offing. The week before, a group of 15 traders had gone to dinner at the private Lynx Club on East 62nd Street, right off Madison. The purpose of the dinner was to discuss how Fuld could be pressured into firing Joe Gregory. If Fuld wouldn't do it, they agreed, they'd threaten to resign en masse. Jeff Weiss, the head of financial services banking, was not at the dinner, nor was Gerald Donini. But both were patched in for the key discussions on speakerphone. Weiss advised against a confrontation. "Dick is not going to react well," he said. "You're not going to get him to move by trying to corner him. Slow down. Things are moving in the right direction. Let this thing out over the next couple of days." At the executive committee meeting the following morning, Fuld looked exhausted, like a boxer gone one round too far. The fight had not gone out of him, but he knew that he had to try another approach. To keep the firm together, he He was going to have to be more conciliatory. "There's a lot of unrest," he acknowledged. "We haven't been together. We've made some mistakes." Then he suggested they go around the table and get everyone's take on the question, "How do we restore confidence?" Everyone was in attendance. Joe Gregory, Tom Russo, Skip McGee, Bart McDade, Stephen Birkenfeld, and a handful by phone. Everyone except Aaron Callan, who was still making calls to investors. Fuld pointedly asked Skip McGee to go first. "Morale has never been worse," McGee told the committee. "We have to admit publicly we made some mistakes. We continue to spin like we've done nothing wrong. We're better than this." McGee paused and then added quietly, "We need to make a senior management change." "What do you mean?" Fold snapped. "We need to hold ourselves accountable. That's what the market wants, and that's what our troops want." While McGee did not mention Gregory by name, everyone at the table understood whom he was talking about. Indeed, just a month earlier, at another executive committee meeting, Gregory had actually offered to resign. "If there's a bullet to be taken, I'll be the one to take the bullet," he said stoically. At the time, everyone had dismissed the comment as a rhetorical flourish, an easy thing to propose when there was little chance of its happening. Fuld continued around the table. As each executive took his turn, making various suggestions, nobody seconded McGee's call for change. Russo, looking at McGee the entire time, chose to make a statement about the importance of teamwork, a sentiment that was then taken up by Gregory. "We've got to stop all the Monday morning quarterbacking," he insisted. "We're all in this together. We've made a lot of decisions over the years, all together. Some have been better than others, but we can work through this together." As the others spoke, McGee, his BlackBerry hidden under the table, typed a two-word message to his colleague, Jeff Weiss. "I'm dead." Returning to his office, McGee called his wife, Susie, in Houston, and told her bluntly, "I may be out of here by the end of the week." That afternoon, the 31st floor had become a gossip mill, a collection of various cliques assembling and reassembling to try to divine what might happen next. Even though Aaron Callan had missed the executive meeting, she had certainly heard about what had transpired there. She was convinced that it was she, not Gregory, who might be on the firing line. And if she had to step down as CFO, she hoped to be able to keep a job of some sort at the firm. So she sent Fuld a two-sentence email without a subject line. "Just to be clear, I am very willing to be part of the accountability of management. Think I have become so closely tied with the performance and the public face of the firm that it may be helpful to put someone else in my role." He didn't reply. By the time Fuld met with the investment bankers for lunch on Wednesday, June 11th, in the wood-paneled private dining room on the 32nd floor, Lehman's stock price had fallen another 21%. This was McGee's show, Fuld knew, and that meant he was going to get tested. He was right. It was 5-on-1. McGee, Roz Stevenson, Mark Shafir, Jeffrey Weiss, and Paul Parker. They jumped at the chance to tell their boss why he needed to make management changes. The real estate investments were killing the firm. Good people had been let go, while novices like Aaron Callan had been promoted to positions out of their depth. Joe Gregory had become distracted and knew nothing about risk. If there was a single problem, he was it. "Look, the answer is somebody's got to pay," Mark Shafir said. "Joe's been with me for 30 years, Fuld shot back. "He's great at what he does. He has a great career. He's done so much for this place. You're asking me to throw him over the side just because we have one bad quarter?" "It's not just a bad quarter," McGee replied. "It's more deep-seated than that." Fuld paused and looked down at the food that he had not touched. "Are you telling me that you want me to—" "No, no," the bankers cried out. They certainly did not want his resignation. His departure would be a death knell for the firm. But the status quo could not continue. Fuld had to break out of the inner circle that was buffering him from the firm and get more involved with its operations. Fuld was willing to accept that criticism. "I get that. That's the feedback I've been getting," he said. "I'm going to do it. I will do the right thing." Still, he would not commit to firing Gregory. "What are you going to say when you leave this meeting?" he asked the bankers. "That the guy doesn't get it," said Weiss, laying it right out on the table.
"I got it," Fuld replied.
As the bankers rose from the table and headed back to the elevator bank, no one was quite certain what Fuld intended to do. It seemed unlikely that he was going to fire Gregory. Nothing he'd said indicated that he was ready to take that drastic a step. Still, McGee and the bankers were relieved to have finally had an audience with Fuld and said their piece. While that lunch had been going on, Gregory was stirring downstairs in his office. He knew the rumors. He could see the sentiment quickly building up against him. Fuld had made enough comments about the morale problem inside the building for him to understand that he was under fire. He wasn't blind to the snippy comments and office rumor mill about him. Indeed, if there was one thing Gregory focused on, what he called culture, he could now see it fraying. His own power, he knew, had started eroding months earlier. Fuld had increasingly leaned on Bart McDade, the firm's head of equities, and one of the most popular guys at the firm, honest, disciplined, and bright, maybe too much for his own good. Indeed, following Bear Stearns's near failure, Fuld had made McDade his de facto risk guy. McDade had long been a fixed-income man, successfully running that division, only to be shunted over to the less profitable equities desk in 2005. In what many in the firm viewed as a classic Joe Gregory disposal of a potential rival. Or maybe, as others saw it, that decision had just been Joe being Joe, playing a hunch that a talent like McDade could be utilized wherever the need was greatest. Though McDade was too polite to have ever said anything in front of the executive committee, he had spoken privately to Gregory about Gregory's role at Lehman, making some not-so-subtle comments about doing the right thing for the firm. And while not as forceful as McGee, McDade had made it clear to Fuld that Gregory had lost his credibility. But by now, that had become obvious to almost all the employees.
Minutes after Fuld returned to his office, Gregory came by.
"I think I should step down," he said uncertainly.
"What's going on here?"
Fuld said, waving him away. "Go back in your office. I get 51% of the vote, and that's not happening."
5 minutes later, Fuld came to speak with Gregory, who was now talking to Russo, discussing what he had just told Fuld. Gregory said that he was convinced the market wanted the firm to take action.
"They want heads," he insisted. "Heads have to rule. And it can't be you," Gregory told Fuld.
"I have to do it."
"It's not your call," Fuld told him. "This is a disease. Every firm has it. It's not your fault."
Russo, who hadn't said anything up until now, chimed in.
"Dick, I think Joe's right."
Under the circumstances, this was best for the firm.
As Fuld began to resign himself to what everyone had come to regard as inevitable, he fought back tears, muttering, "I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't like it."
Erin Callan was in her office when Gregory came in to break the news. He was leaving, he said, out of loyalty to the firm. And as her mentor, he had one last request. He asked her to step down as well, arguing that while his departure might affect morale internally, her brand name was the one that mattered to Wall Street.
"We should do it together," he said.
Though she had sent the email to Fuld, Callan felt stricken, unable to believe it had come to this. Minutes later, she went to see Fuld.
"I lost credibility with our investors, and I think I have to step down," she said, her voice quivering.
Again, Fuld felt overwhelmed, the tears rising to his eyes. But he had been here before. He could go on. Left alone in his office, he started to put the new pieces in place. He called Jeff Weiss.
"I'm listening," he told Weiss.
Okay, Weiss replied, not entirely certain what Fuld was driving at.
"I'm listening," Fuld repeated,
as if to suggest that Weiss's comments at lunch were being heeded.
"Do I have to tell you how I feel about Bart McDade?" Weiss said, essentially endorsing him for Gregory's job.
"No," Fuld said, "you do not." That night,
McGee was dining with a college friend at Maloney and Porcelli, a steakhouse on 50th Street, when his mobile phone rang. It was Fuld. McGee stepped outside under the restaurant's green awning to take the call.
"Okay, I just want you to know that I heard you," Fuld said, "and I've got the ball."
"What?" McGee asked. Fuld didn't answer.
"I may be a dumbass from Texas," McGee said, "but can you be a bit more explicit?"
"I heard you," Fuld said. "I've got the ball." He told McGee to be at a special executive committee board meeting the following morning at 8 o'clock sharp. Now McGee understood. On Thursday morning, Kerry Cohen began receiving voicemails from Charlie Gasparino at 6 o'clock.
"Hey, Kerry, you better call me back right now because this is a problem. You guys specifically denied something that I heard, and now it sounds to me like it's true. So you better call me back now. Now means now. I better not get scooped on this. You're going to have a huge credibility problem, and so will Lehman. So call me now."
20 minutes later, he followed up.
"I better get a call back from you before this hits the tape. I am not kidding."
Cohen had, in fact, been called in at 5:30 a.m. to work with Scott Friedheim on drafting the press release announcing Gregory's resignation and Callan's decision to step down. Callan had worked a deal with Fuld to remain at the firm in another role. Though it was not detailed in the release, Gregory would also be staying on, allowed by Fuld to remain on the Lehman payroll as an out-of-the-way consultant so that he could continue to qualify for his pension and deferred compensation. Gregory's career was over, but his old friend never did quite pull the trigger on him. In the press statement, Fuld said of Gregory, "Joe has been my partner for 30 years and has been a driving force behind where we are today and what we have achieved as a firm. This has been one of the most difficult decisions either of us has ever had to make." Friedheim also helped prepare a note to the staff from Fuld. "Our credibility has eroded," Fuld said. "The current market environment is forcing us to take a number of measures to regain the confidence of all our constituents." For a change, that morning, the newspapers had nothing new on Lehman. When Fuld arrived in the office, Friedheim handed him a draft of the press release to review, and then they started the executive committee meeting. Fuld looked distraught. "This is the hardest thing I've ever done," he said as he went on to describe Gregory's role as a friend and business partner. "Joe is taking one for the team." "I always said that if anyone should take a bullet, it should be me," Gregory said. "Let's not let this be wasted." As Fuld again looked as if he were about to well up, Gregory grabbed his hand and said quietly, "It's okay."
"Do you want to say anything?" Fuld asked Callan.
"No. No," she replied, wiping away a tear. Announcing that he planned to name Bart McDade as Gregory's successor, Fuld said, "He's the best operator we have." But this was no time to celebrate McDade's appointment. As the meeting came to an end, Fuld gave Gregory one final heartfelt hug, and then watched as he slowly left the conference room.
Chapter 7. On the afternoon of June 11th, Greg Fleming, the disarmingly youthful-looking 45-year-old president of Merrill Lynch, was meeting with clients at the firm's headquarters when his secretary quietly slipped him a note marked "Urgent." Larry Fink, chief executive of the investment management behemoth BlackRock, was on the line and needed to talk. Fleming couldn't imagine what might be important enough to justify the interruption, but given the commotion in the market, he agreed to take the call. Rumors that morning claimed that BlackRock might be a candidate to buy Lehman Brothers. Fink had only encouraged the speculation by appearing on CNBC earlier that day and declaring, "Lehman is not a Bear Stearns situation. Lehman Brothers is adequately structured in terms of avoiding a liquidity crisis." The two executives were close. Fink, a 55-year-old financier, had lent Fleming and his banking team office space after the September 11th attacks drove Merrill employees out of their downtown headquarters. And their two firms were now partners, as Fleming had helped broker a 2006 deal to merge Merrill's $539 billion asset management business with BlackRock in exchange for a stake of nearly 50% in the firm. The deal had vaulted BlackRock, long known as a bond house,
into the $1 trillion asset club and had established Fink, who helped create the mortgage-backed security market in the 1980s, as an even more influential power broker on Wall Street. "What the fuck is going on?" Fink, nearly breathless with anger, screamed into the phone as soon as Fleming greeted him. "Just tell me what the fuck is going on. How could he do this? How could he do this to me?" "Larry, Larry," Fleming tried to calm him. "What are you talking about?" "Thane," Fink bellowed, referring to John Thane, Merrill Lynch's chief executive. "CNBC says he's putting BlackRock on the block. What the fuck is he thinking?"
"Larry, I know nothing about it," Fleming replied, genuinely baffled.
"When did he say this?"
"In a speech. Today he announces to the whole world that the stake is up for sale."
"What fucking idiot does that?" Fink shouted, still at the same pitch of fury.
"I didn't know John was giving a speech, but we have a lockup, Greg. You know that. John knows. He has to ask my permission. He hasn't called me. Nothing. He has no fucking right to sell BlackRock."
"Larry, I know we have a lockup agreement. Just take a deep breath and listen," Fleming urged him.
"Think about it," Fink continued. "What seller announces to the world he's selling? Just think about the stupidity of this."
"As far as I know, no one at Merrill wants to change the relationship we have with you," Fleming replied. "BlackRock is a strategically critical asset for us. Let me find John, find out what happened, and the three of us will talk this out," he promised, and ended the conversation. The only speaking engagement of Thane's of which Fleming was aware had taken place the previous day at a conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal. In it, he had made no notable mention of BlackRock. Indeed, Fleming had been impressed with Thane's objective assessment of the state of the industry during his talk. "Everyone is shrinking their balance sheet. There was too much leverage in the system, too much credit for too long," Thane had said, assuming the role of the industry elder statesman. "We all have concerns about what we read in the papers." Fleming called Thane's office, but was told that he was away. Fleming knew that BlackRock's balance sheet had continued to deteriorate. It was loaded with subprime loans the company had been unable to get rid of, and it likely needed to raise more money. But Fleming didn't expect that Thane would actually want to sell BlackRock, which many considered Merrill's most solid asset. Announcing a sale would only put more pressure on Merrill. Like Lehman Brothers, Merrill had been struggling with its own crisis of confidence. For the past several months, Thane had repeatedly told investors that the firm had marked or valued its assets conservatively and wouldn't need to raise additional capital. But investors had been skeptical, knocking Merrill's shares down 32% for the year. Thane, Paulson's former number two at Goldman Sachs, had been brought in to run Merrill just 7 months earlier to help restore some semblance of order after the firm reported its biggest loss in history and ousted its chief executive, Stan O'Neill. At the time, Larry Fink actually thought he was the top candidate for the job, only to find out by reading the New York Post's website that he had lost out to Thane. His own job interview was supposed to have been later that week, which might explain some of his frustration with Thane. An ultra-straight-laced executive who was sometimes referred to as iRobot, Thane had appealed to Merrill's board because of his newly minted reputation as a turnaround artist. After rising rapidly through the ranks at Goldman, he left to overhaul the New York Stock Exchange after the extravagant compensation package for its CEO, Richard Grasso, caused an outrage. Fink, ironically, had led the exchange's search committee that selected him. At the NYSE, Thane, who, perhaps not surprisingly, took a post-Grasso $16 million pay cut, unleashed a radical transformation, shaking the world's largest stock exchange out of its clubby, anachronistic ways. He cut perks, shutting the wood-paneled luncheon club and firing the exchange's barber, and turned the exchange into a for-profit, publicly traded company. He took on the powerful, entrenched constituency of floor traders and specialists, who protested in vain as Thane dragged them into the electronic trading age. Thane, who had grown up in Antioch, Illinois, a small town just west of Lake Michigan, had always been considered a talented problem solver. In his junior year at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, when he interned at Procter & Gamble,
He made a simple but highly significant observation of an assembly line he was supervising. The workers were making ivory soap, and whenever technical problems forced the line to come to a halt, they would wait for it to start up again before getting back to work. The college boy persuaded the workers that there was no reason to stop. They could keep making soap and stack the boxes on the side until the line came back on. That way, their bonuses, which were based on production, would not be affected. Thane won them over, especially after he pitched in and stacked boxes himself. While his public image as a callous technocrat may not have been entirely fair, Thane did have his weaknesses. With an engineering background, he could come across as a purely linear thinker who sometimes seemed remarkably tone-deaf. When he made conversation, he would explain the things in detail to almost the point that I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, Steve Vasquez, one of his peers from high school, said. At a meeting at Goldman in 1999, Thane told a roomful of bankers and lawyers, "Would it hurt you to suck up to me once in a while?" He thought he was being funny. Others couldn't tell. The incident that had so enraged Fink turned out to be just another example of his tin ear, as Fleming ultimately discovered. Thane had been taking part in a conference call with Deutsche Bank investors when Michael Mayo, the analyst running the call, asked him, "So, I think you said before that you're comfortable with BlackRock and Bloomberg. Is that still the case? Under what circumstances would you say it doesn't make sense to have those investments anymore?" Thane, reasonably enough, took the question to be a hypothetical. Of course, Merrill needed to look at all its assets and figure out which ones could be turned into cold, hard cash, he said. In this environment, any investment bank needed to do that. At the end of last year, when we were looking to raise capital, we looked at various options, which included selling common, selling converts, Thane replied, but also included using some of the valuable assets that we have on our balance sheet, like Bloomberg and BlackRock. And if we were to raise more capital, we would continue that process of evaluating what alternatives we had and what made the most sense for us to do from a capital efficiency point of view. Thane's answer might have made plenty of sense to himself, but having heard him repeatedly say, "We have plenty of capital going forward," investors took it as a not-so-subtle hint, and the damage was done. Within 72 hours, Merrill was being described as the most vulnerable brokerage after Lehman. For a single day, John Thane had the job that he had wanted for his entire career, to be the CEO of Goldman Sachs. That day, unfortunately, was September 11, 2001. As the company's actual CEO, Hank Paulson, was on a plane headed to Hong Kong when the attacks took place, Thane, the firm's co-president, was the most senior executive at 85 Broad Street, Goldman's headquarters, and somebody had to take control. His other co-president, John Thornton, was in Washington, D.C. for a meeting at the Brookings Institution. Thane had always been certain that his destiny was to run Goldman himself one day. Over the Christmas holiday of 1998, he had taken part, perhaps even instigated, the palace coup that forced John Corzine out and put Hank Paulson in charge of Goldman. At Robert Hurst's Fifth Avenue apartment, Thane and Thornton had agreed to support Paulson, but they thought they had received an informal promise in exchange. Paulson said he planned to be the CEO for only 2 years, as a transition, until he could move back to Chicago, and then they expected the job to be bequeathed to them. With Corzine off skiing in Telluride, Colorado, they made their pact. For Thane, a longtime lieutenant and friend of Corzine, it was a heart-wrenching decision, but backing Paulson, whom he genuinely believed would make a better leader than Corzine, enabled him to advance his own career. As the person closest to Corzine on the executive committee, Thane was the one to have to break the news to him, and he was forced to watch as his boss fought back tears. Goldman partners, many just back from vacation, received a terse email from Paulson and Corzine on the morning of January 11, 1999. John has decided to relinquish the CEO title. But after 2 years passed, Paulson showed no interest in stepping aside as he realized how much work he still had to accomplish and was unsure about whether his successors were up to the task. Thane, like any senior Goldman partner, had become outrageously wealthy
accumulating several $100 million in stock from the IPO. But he realized that his boss wasn't going anywhere soon, and his dream of running Goldman would remain just that. Thane and Paulson got along well, but there was now an underlying tension. Thane resented the fact that Paulson hadn't stuck to what he thought was their agreement, while for his part, Paulson questioned whether Thane, whom he respected as a talented financier, had the sound judgment to be CEO. He was also bothered by Thane's un-Goldman-like displays of wealth. Though Thane was in many ways understated, he never appeared in the society pages, for example. He bought a 10-acre property in Rye and owned 5 BMWs. Paulson was also irked by Thane's vacation rituals. While normally a hard worker, Thane was always determined to take a 2-week trip to Vail at Christmas time, a week over Easter, and then another 2 weeks in the summer. For a perpetual worker like Paulson, it was a tough pill to swallow. By 2003, it was clear to both Thane and Thornton that Paulson wasn't going anywhere. Thornton, who by then had grown frustrated he had not been elevated, decided to leave. Soon after his departure, he took Thane out to dinner. "You can't rely on Hank's previous words," Thornton said. "If I were you, I'd be getting out of here." Only several months later, Paulson appointed a former commodities trader named Lloyd Blankfein to be co-president with Thane. The ascension of Blankfein, who was building his own power base at the firm, not just politically, but through sheer profits, as he oversaw a business that accounted for 80% of Goldman's earnings, was a sure sign to Thane to begin looking for an exit. Paulson was speechless when Thane marched into his office to tell him he was leaving to become CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. Thane subsequently went on to deserved success in the position. 4 years later, with the credit crisis deepening in the fall of 2007, several large banks started taking huge losses and firing their CEOs. Thane was a natural candidate for firms looking for an upgrade. Indeed, he had been considered for the position not just at Merrill Lynch, but also at Citigroup, along with Tim Geithner. He debated with himself and with his wife, Carmen, about whether he would take the Merrill job if it was offered to him. He had done his own due diligence on the firm's books and was satisfied that, despite the roughly $90 billion in shaky loans and derivatives on its balance sheets, it was manageable. But more than that, he saw it as an opportunity to be a CEO of a major brokerage firm, to get the job he had never landed at Goldman. Given his contacts and reputation, he also saw Merrill as a platform from which he could beat Goldman at its own game. He judged the effort to be at least a 5-year project. He told Merrill's board it would take him 2 years to fix the balance sheet and another 3 to take the firm to the next level. He eventually accepted the position and was paid a $15 million signing bonus and a $750,000 annual salary. The board also granted him options that would amount to another $72 million if he could bring Merrill's shares above $100. They rose 1.6% to $57.86 on the news that Thane would come on board, but still had a long way to go for that bonus to kick in. As soon as he arrived, he moved quickly to shore up Merrill's capital base, hoping to move a step ahead of the problem. His frame of reference was the end of Drexel Burnham Lambert, Michael Milken's firm, which had filed for bankruptcy in 1990. The demise of Drexel was really a liquidity problem, he said at one of the firm's Wednesday morning risk committee meetings, explaining how the firm didn't have enough cash on hand. Liquidity is the most important thing. In December and January, Merrill raised $12.8 billion from the sovereign wealth funds Temasek Holdings of Singapore and the Kuwait Investment Authority, among other investors. At the same time, he went about dismantling the O'Neill Empire. When he first arrived, he noticed that the security guards at Merrill's headquarters just across from Ground Zero always kept an entire elevator bank open exclusively for him. Thane walked over to one of the other elevators, and the moment he entered, all the employees shuffled out. "What's the matter? Why are you getting off?" he asked. "We can't ride the elevator with you," the employees told him. "That's crazy. Get back in here," he said, as he instructed security to open up the elevator bank for everyone. He also went about slashing costs by selling one of the firm's G4 planes and a helicopter. No target was too small.
The freshly cut flowers that were costing the firm some $200,000 a year were replaced with silk ones. At the same time, in a paradox that was not lost on his staff, Thane began spending serious money on talent. In late April, with the approval of Merrill's board, he hired an old friend from Goldman, Thomas K. Montag, as his head of trading and sales. To lure him away, the firm agreed to a signing bonus of $39.4 million, even though Montag wouldn't begin work until August. In May, Thane would hire Peter Krause, another Goldman man, whom he guaranteed a $25 million golden parachute. And then there was his office. He and his wife had decided it was badly in need of a renovation. O'Neill's white formica furniture didn't match the rest of the Merrill decor, and an adjacent conference room had been turned into O'Neill's personal gym, complete with an exercise bike and weights. Thane hired celebrity interior decorator Michael S. Smith, whose clients included Steven Spielberg and Dustin Hoffman, to renovate his office, the adjoining conference space, and the reception area, including repainting, carpentry, and electrical work. Thane didn't pay much attention to the details, focusing mainly on the fact that Smith had happily brought over his favorite desk from his old office at the NYSE. But Smith billed the firm $800,000 for his services and submitted an itemized list of goods that included an $87,000 area rug, a $68,000 credenza, and a $35,115 commode. The executives in the billing department who cut the checks, however, were so aghast at such profligacy that they made copies of the receipts, which they would later use against him. For all of Thane's efforts to improve morale, he seemed to be achieving precisely the opposite. On the trading floor, 39.4, a sly reference to Montag's bonus, became a popular way to punctuate a sentence instead of using an expletive. While Merrill executives praised Thane for his prescient efforts to raise capital, there were grumblings that, as a manager, he was either too much of a micromanager, or more likely the opposite, too detached. When he hired a new chief of staff, May Lee, he didn't mention it to any of the firm's top inner circle until, on her first day on the job, she took a seat at an executive committee meeting with all of them. Robert McCann, who ran the firm's brokerage business, walked into the room, noticed the stranger, and looked at Thane quizzically. "Oh, I probably should have told you," Thane said matter-of-factly. "This is my new chief of staff." He also rankled some executive committee members with his grandiose media appearances, in which he cast himself as the great savior of Merrill. He brought in Margaret Tutwiler, a former State Department spokeswoman in G.H.W. Bush's administration, to run communications. Within the firm, some thought he might be angling for the Treasury Secretary post if John McCain, the Republican frontrunner, was victorious. By that June 11th, when Larry Fink made his enraged call about BlackRock, it had become clear that the capital that Merrill Lynch had raised from Temasek and KIA, the sovereign wealth funds, back in December, was still insufficient, and that those deals were proving to be much more expensive than they appeared at the time. Under their terms, the investors were entitled to additional payouts to compensate for any dilution in their holdings if Merrill issued new shares at a lower stock price. Merrill's stock price, meanwhile, had slid steeply. To add $1 billion in new capital, the firm might actually have to raise an amount nearly three times that to compensate the 2007 investors. Thane could also see that the second quarter was shaping up to be worse than the first, though he didn't know how bad it would ultimately be. Merrill's problems were by now becoming evident to others on Wall Street, feeding a perception that Thane did not have a solid grasp on the firm. As the banking analyst Mayo told Thane on the conference call that got him in trouble with Fink, "It's kind of raise as you go is the perception. As you have the losses, you raise more capital. Maybe it's more of a perception in the industry, if you disagree. At what point do you say, let's just get far ahead of anything that could come our way?" "I don't agree with the way you characterized it," Thane replied. "We raised $12.8 billion of new capital at the end of the year. We only lost $8.6 billion. We raised almost 50% extra, and so we did raise more than we lost. The same actually was true at the end of the first quarter. We raised $2.7 billion versus the $2 billion we lost.
so we have been raising extra.
But that would not be enough.
Several weeks after Merrill's board had named Thane CEO, he was faced with an especially delicate task. Placing a call to his predecessor, Stan O'Neill, who had just negotiated an exit package for himself totaling $161.5 million, Thane asked if they might get together. Hoping to keep their meeting out of the newspapers, the two decided on breakfast in Midtown, at the office of O'Neill's lawyer. After a few pleasantries, O'Neill stared levelly at Thane and asked, "So, why do you want to talk to me?" Thane knew that if there was one person in the world who could explain what had gone wrong at Merrill Lynch, why it had loaded up on $27.2 billion of subprime and other risky investments, what, in other words, had gone wrong on Wall Street, it was O'Neill.
"Well, as you know, I'm new, and you were the CEO for 5 years," Thane said carefully. "I'd like to get your take, any insight on what happened here. Who everybody is, and all that. It would be very helpful to me and to Merrill."
O'Neill was silent for a moment, picking at his fruit plate, and then looked up at Thane.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I don't think I'm the right person to answer that question."
O'Neill was out of a different mold than most of Merrill's top executives, not least of all because he was African-American, quite a change from the succession of white Irish Catholics who had headed the firm in the past. His was, by any measure, an amazing success story. O'Neill, whose grandfather had been born a slave, had spent much of his childhood in a wood-frame house with no indoor plumbing on a farm in eastern Alabama. When Stan was 12, his father moved the family to a housing project in Atlanta, where he soon found a job at a nearby General Motors assembly plant. GM became Stan O'Neill's ticket out of poverty. After high school, he enrolled at the General Motors Institute, now known as Kettering University, an engineering college, on a work-study scholarship that involved his working 6 weeks on the assembly line in Flint, Michigan, followed by 6 weeks in the classroom. With GM's support, he attended Harvard Business School, graduating in 1978. After a period working in GM's Treasury Department in New York, he was persuaded in 1986 by a former GM treasurer, then at Merrill Lynch, to join the brokerage firm on its junk bond desk. Through hard work and support from powerful mentors, O'Neill rose rapidly through the ranks. He eventually came to oversee the junk bond unit, which rose to the top of the Wall Street rankings known as league tables. In 1997, he was named a co-head of the institutional client business, the following year, chief financial officer, and in 2002, CEO. The firm for which O'Neill was now responsible had been founded in 1914 by Charles Merrill, a stocky Floridian known to his friends as Good Time Charlie, whose mission was bringing Wall Street to Main Street. Merrill set up brokerage branches in nearly 100 cities across the nation, connected to the home office by teletype. He helped democratize and demystify the stock market by using promotions, like giving away shares in a contest sponsored by Wheaties. More than the mutual fund giant Fidelity or any bank, Merrill Lynch, with its bull logo, became identified with the new investing class that emerged in the decades after World War II. The percentage of Americans who owned stock, whether directly or indirectly through mutual funds and retirement plans, more than doubled from 1983 to 1999, by which point nearly half the country were investors in the market. Merrill Lynch was "Bullish on America," an advertising slogan at first used in 1971, and America was just as bullish on Merrill Lynch. By 2000, however, the thundering herd had become the phlegmatic herd, a bit too fat and complacent. The firm had gone on a shopping binge in the 1990s, accelerating its global expansion and swelling its workforce to 72,000, compared to the 62,700 of its closest rival, Morgan Stanley. Meanwhile, its traditional power base, the retail brokerage business, was being undercut by the rise of discount online brokerage firms like E-Trade and Ameritrade. And because much of Merrill Lynch's investment banking business was predicated on volume, not profits, the dot-com crash in the stock market the previous year had left Merrill vulnerable, exposing its high costs and thin margins. The man tasked with shrinking Merrill back to a manageable size was O'Neill.
although colleagues had urged him to proceed slowly, especially in light of the trauma of 9/11, in which Merrill had lost three of its employees. O'Neill plowed ahead with little regard for the effects of downsizing on the firm's morale and culture. Within a year, Merrill's workforce had been cut by an astonishing 25%, a loss of more than 15,000 jobs. "I think this is a great firm, but greatness is not an entitlement," O'Neill remarked at the time. "There are some things about our culture I don't want to change, but I don't like maternalism or paternalism in a corporate setting, as the name Mother Merrill implies." The management turnover that accompanied his ascension was likewise startling. Even before he officially became chief executive in December 2002, almost half of the 19 members of the firm's executive committee were gone. It became clear that O'Neill would force out anyone whom he had any reason to distrust. "Ruthless," O'Neill would tell associates, "isn't always that bad." If a colleague dared stand up to him, O'Neill was famous for fighting back. When Peter Kelly, a top Merrill Lynch lawyer, challenged him about an investment, O'Neill called security to have him physically removed from his office. Some employees began referring to O'Neill's top management team as the Taliban and calling O'Neill Mullah Omar. As well as by vigorous cost-cutting, O'Neill had plans to make Merrill great again through redirecting the firm into riskier but more lucrative strategies. O'Neill's model for this approach was Goldman, which had begun aggressively making bets using its own account rather than simply trading on behalf of its clients. He zealously tracked Goldman's quarterly numbers, and he would hound his associates about performance. As it happened, O'Neill lived in the same building as Lloyd Blankfein, a daily reminder of exactly whom he was chasing. Blankfein and his wife had come to jokingly refer to O'Neill as Doppler Stan, because whenever they'd run into him in the lobby, O'Neill would always keep moving, often walking in circles, they thought, to avoid having a conversation. O'Neill did force through a transformation of Merrill that, in its first few years, resulted in a bonanza. In 2006, Merrill Lynch made $7.5 billion from trading its own money and that of its clients, compared with $2.6 billion in 2002. Almost overnight, it became a major player in the booming business of private equity. O'Neill also ramped up the firm's use of leverage, particularly in mortgage securitization. He saw how firms like Lehman were minting money on investments tied to mortgages, and he wanted some of that action from Merrill. In 2003, he lured Christopher Ricciardi, a 34-year-old star in mortgage securitization, from Credit Suisse. Merrill was an also-ran in the market for collateralized debt obligations, which were often built with tranches from mortgage-backed securities. In just 2 years, Merrill became the biggest CDO issuer on Wall Street. Creating and selling CDOs generated lucrative fees for Merrill, just as it had for other banks. But even this wasn't enough. Merrill sought to be a full-line producer, issuing mortgages, packaging them into securities, and then slicing and dicing them to CDOs. The firm began buying up mortgage servicers and commercial real estate firms, more than 30 in all, and in December 2006, it acquired one of the biggest subprime mortgage lenders in the nation, First Franklin, for $1.3 billion. But just as Merrill began moving deeper into mortgages, the housing market started to show its first signs of distress. By late 2005, with prices peaking, American International Group, one of the biggest insurers of CDOs through credit default swaps, stopped insuring securities with any subprime tranches. Ricciardi, meanwhile, having built Merrill into a CDO powerhouse, left Merrill in February 2006 to head a boutique investment firm, Cohen Brothers. With his departure, Dow Kim, a Merrill executive, sought to rally those who stayed behind on the CDO front. Merrill, he promised, would maintain its ranking as the top CDO issuer, doing whatever it takes. One deal Kim put together was something he called Costa Bella, a $500 billion CDO, for which Merrill received a $5 million fee. But Jeffrey Kronthal, a Merrill executive who had helped recruit Ricciardi to Merrill, had been growing increasingly concerned that a storm was threatening not just extravagant projects like Costa Bella,
but the entire CDO market, and he began to urge caution. He insisted the firm maintain its $3 billion ceiling on CDOs with subprime tranches. Kronthal's wariness put him directly in the path of O'Neill's ambition to be the mortgage leader on Wall Street, a situation that was clearly untenable. In July 2006, Kronthal,